The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
A very good morning, Mr. Reich.
Hi, Chad. Morning to you. I was reading about comments made yesterday by South Africa's Foreign Minister Naledi Pandor, who decided that she feels that Israel should be classified as an apartheid state and has actually called upon the United Nations General Assembly to establish a committee to verify whether Israel satisfies the requirements of being classified as an apartheid state. These were comments that were made by Dr. Pandor yesterday at a meeting of the Palestinian Heads of Mission in Africa, a meeting that's held in Pretoria. So I'd like to just respond very briefly to the comments by Dr. Pandor. First of all, I'm not quite sure if she's had the opportunity to visit Israel, but I would personally like to invite her to come here and to see for herself whether she thinks that Israel satisfies the requirements to be classified as an apartheid state. I personally doubt very much that she would still be of the same view if she had had personally the opportunity to visit Israel and to witness for herself what goes on here and to compare it to what she would recall personally from apartheid as it was in the day of her generation. And as I say, I very much doubt whether she will still be of the view that Israel satisfies the requirements to be classified as an apartheid state. That's the first thing. The second thing is that I know that when she talks about the Palestinian issue, she has really called upon the idea of trying to come to an agreement, some sort of a peace arrangement between Israel and the Palestinians in order to allow for a Palestinian state to come into existence. And I think that that particular view is very much supported across the board, even within Israeli politics. The idea of a two-state solution has been discussed at length and is very much supported by many politicians and indeed individual Israelis on the street. That doesn't necessarily mean the fact that we haven't yet managed to come to some sort of a negotiated settlement doesn't necessarily turn Israel into an apartheid state. But the point is that there is this Palestinian Authority area where Palestinians are entitled to exercise their rights and to live and to come under the auspices of the Palestinian Authority. So I don't think that the fact that there isn't a negotiated settlement necessarily means, therefore, that there is an apartheid situation. I think, on the contrary, that people have the right to live under the auspices of the Palestinian Authority, where they have the opportunity to express themselves, to vote, to live in the Palestinian democratic society as it currently presents itself. I'm not suggesting that it's fully democratic, because there haven't been elections there for some years. But the point is that those people who wish to express themselves as Palestinians have the opportunity to live there. So I don't necessarily subscribe to her view that all of this situation that we find ourselves in necessarily therefore translates into it or equals Israel is an apartheid state. And I just wanted to express that view and to challenge what she had said yesterday, and of course to invite her to visit and to see firsthand. That was the first thing. And with your permission, Chad, I'm going to be a little bit longer in talking about a little snippet, which is really a much bigger snippet. And this is a story that goes back a few years. Let's roll back the clock 10 years to a time when a young Jewish student, Max Steinberg, decided to embark upon a birthright tour, came to Israel for the first time. He and members of his family living in Los Angeles had never visited Israel. He came on birthright. And while he was on birthright, he called his parents to say, "I'm coming to live in Israel. This is the place that I want to be." The country had such an impact on him that he decided he wanted to make Israel his home. And indeed, he did that. He made Aliyah, he came to Israel, and he signed up as a lone soldier with the IDF, where he was recruited to the Golani Brigade, which is one of Israel's premier combat units. He joined Golani, and he was serving in the IDF alongside many other lone soldiers and indeed Israeli soldiers when Operation Protective Edge broke out. now going back 8 years to 2014, and Golani soldiers were sent into Gaza in order to fight against the militants who were in Gaza firing rockets towards Israel. Max was alongside members, colleagues in the Golani Brigade. They were in a people carrier, an armed vehicle, which stalled near Shajaiya in Gaza. They were in the Gaza Strip, and unfortunately, the vehicle was struck by an anti-tank missile, and seven Golani soldiers were killed, including Max. And so it was that Max's parents, Evie and Stuart, made their first trip to Israel to attend the funeral of their son Max, Sergeant Max Lineberg, and also to sit Shiva for him, the traditional seven-day mourning period that is observed after somebody dies. And there was a concern that there wouldn't be enough to have a quorum, a minyan, at the funeral for Max, because the family knew nobody in Israel. And so the call went out to Israelis to come to Mount Herzl, to the military cemetery, to attend the funeral of Sergeant Max Steinberg. And there wasn't a minyan. There weren't only 10 people. There were 30,000 Israelis who came to the funeral. And that particular event was so marked on the minds of Stuart and Evie Steinberg that they've made a trip to Israel each and every year after that in order to mark the Yahrzeit, the anniversary of the death of Max. And so it was this year that exactly this week, in fact, exactly 8 years after Max was buried, that they gathered, this time not with 30,000 people, but still with 100 people around the grave of Max Steinberg. And Evie and Stuart have become so attached to Israel, as indeed their family have, in spite of all of that experience that they've been through. And I think it's an amazing story to tell. And I still recall the 30,000 people who jammed the streets of Jerusalem, coming from the north of Israel, coming from the south of Israel, coming from east and west, in order to be in Jerusalem, to try to get to Mount Herzl, to the military cemetery, to accompany Max on his last journey to his final resting place, and of course to gather around his family, to envelop them, to put a literal hug around them in order to try somehow to console them in the death of their son. I think that the story still has an amazing meaning, and it certainly has an emotional effect on me, and I just wanted to share that with you and the listeners.
Thank you, Anthony. Moving on to the news that's coming out of Israel and the world, the family of the Palestinian journalist who was killed in crossfire between Israeli troops and Palestinian gunmen, the family were in Washington to meet with the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken. Do you know what the agenda for that meeting was?
So, of course, this is the story that surrounds the death of Shireen Abu Akleh. We all recall from a few months ago, she was a journalist covering a particular event, some sort of a conflict between IDF soldiers and Palestinian gunmen in the area of Jenin. And she was killed by what can only be considered to be a stray bullet, because I don't believe at all for a moment that there was any decision, that there was any intention to somehow aim the bullet towards her, whether it be a Palestinian bullet or an Israeli bullet. That fact has yet to be determined, but I don't believe that anybody would have had the intention to kill her. In the event, she was killed in the crossfire, and since then, she has become something of a poster child for the conflict, and of course, for in particular, for IDF, what's considered by at least by the Palestinian side to be IDF belligerence against Palestinians. And yesterday, it was Lina Abu Akleh, who is the niece of Shireen, who visited the U.S. And she had the audience, she had the ear of the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, to ask the United States government to carry out an official investigation into the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh and to report upon who is ultimately responsible. What she said was that they wish to pursue accountability for her murder, wherever it may take us. And it is her view and the view of the family that Israeli gunmen, the Israeli IDF troops, intentionally killed Shireen Abu Akleh. That is their base assumption. And they sought a meeting with President Joe Biden when he was in Israel a few weeks ago in order to discuss this matter with him. As it turns out, they were not able to get a meeting with the president, but instead they have been referred to the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, in order to request him to get the U.S. administration to carry out a more official investigation, obviously with the result being predetermined from the family's point of view, at least. They already know what the result should be, and all they're asking for is the U.S. to officially confirm that this indeed was what went on. Of course, this is a very, very unlikely situation to occur because the U.S. administration, like the Israeli government, doesn't feel that such an investigation would necessarily be helpful. There's already been a lot of investigation around the particular bullet that it is claimed killed her, and there is no way of determining the source of that bullet, whether it came from one particular weapon or another. And yet the family are still pursuing this particular agenda in order to somehow force the U.S. government into conducting a formal investigation. And of course, coming out with the answer that the family feels is the right answer, which is that the Israeli IDF troops purposely targeted Shireen and killed her with intention rather than accidentally as part of the crossfire. I still don't rule out the possibility that one of the IDF troops may well have killed Shireen Abu Akleh. It is certainly a possibility, but I have very, very little doubt in my mind that it was all done unintentionally and that she just happened to be in the crossfire and unfortunately caught the bullet. So, unfortunately, you know, as far as I'm concerned, meetings like this will take us nowhere very, very quickly indeed.
Anthony, another story that's in the news, of course, is the breakdown in relations between Russia and Israel over the Jewish Agency. This has now become a domestic political disagreement. What's the latest on this matter?
Well, former Prime Minister Netanyahu has decided to jump on the bandwagon and grab the opportunity to accuse the current government of not managing the relationship with Russia up to the standard that he claims he would have expected. And of course, by insinuation, he is trying to suggest that the way that he handled the relationship with Russia, which has always been somewhat controversial, the way that he handled the relationship with Russia when he was prime minister was a lot better than the current situation. So it's unsurprising that he's decided to jump up and to take advantage of the situation and to use it against the current government, and of course to use it also as part of his electioneering platform, because we are in an election time. There will be an election on the 1st of November, and it's unsurprising that former Prime Minister Netanyahu is using this particular issue. What he's saying is that that current Prime Minister Yair Lapid has done damage to Israel's relationship with Russia as a result of not handling this particular issue very well. It still continues to be a major, major problem in the relationship between Israel and Russia. With the it's unclear at the moment as to what Russia is demanding over the closure of the Jewish Agency, whether in fact they are going to be insisting upon that. But in the meantime, many, many other stories have come out, including the fact that some S-300 missile was fired towards Israeli planes during a time that attacks were being carried out in Syria. Of course, the Syria area is highly controversial, with the Russian troops very much stationed there, and Israel's relationship with Russia also being determined to a large degree by things that are going on in Syria. So for now, at least, the relationship with Russia is still on ice, and I'm sure that the next few days will bring out some further developments in terms of how this relationship progresses.
And in closing, a story I've been wanting to chat to you about for most of the week. LL is due to open a direct route to Australia. This must be great news, especially for our Australian listeners.
Well, this is really good news and a little bit surprising, because I don't think that this had been really expected. But the reason that El Al has now decided to announce a direct route to Australia, although they don't say exactly when the route will be opened up, but they have announced that there is an intention to operate a direct flight from Israel to Australia. And the reason that this has been enabled is because of the fact that Saudi Arabia will open its airspace, or has opened its airspace, to Israeli planes. This will allow El Al to overfly Saudi Arabia on its way to Australia. We understand that there will be flights ultimately to Melbourne and perhaps also to Sydney. The flying time, we understand, will be something like 15 hours from Ben Gurion Airport directly to Australia, which is similar to El Al's flights from Ben Gurion Airport to Los Angeles, approximately the same length of time. And it also means that El Al can consider the possibility of opening a direct flight to Tokyo as well, something which had been planned before the pandemic, but which now has also been made a lot easier by the opening of the Saudi airspace to Israeli planes. Not only is El Al considering opening those two routes, but indeed there are some other routes that El Al is in the process of talking about opening, including a direct flight to Dublin and possibly flights to other parts of the world as well. So El Al is certainly trying to expand upon its routes, but I think that our Australian friends will certainly be delighted to hear that ultimately there will be the possibility of a direct flight soon enough from Australia to Israel.
Anthony, thank you so much. I don't know who else was in their mind conjuring up a map of the Middle East to see how Israel will be flying over Saudi Arabia. I, for one, was conjuring up the map so that I could map it out. But that 15-hour flight will be very welcome to a lot of our listeners in Australia and to a lot of Jews in Australia. Anthony, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much, and we'll talk again tomorrow.
Thank you.